Okay, full hour to go now. Phone calls with you and our physicist, Nassim Hedamain, and that'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we are. We'll take your phone calls. Nassim Hedamain, our special guest tonight. He's also got a DVD called Crossing the Event Horizon, Rise to the Equation. Tell me about that, Nassim.
Well, it's a 4-DVD set that goes through all the information relevant to, you know, a layman description of the theory and all the research I've done in ancient civilization and in various fields of expertise. And it describes the link between all these things, the link between advanced physics and ancient knowledge and even, you know, the possibility that we're being talked to by crop circle and taught about geometry and so on, and many different other things are involved. It's almost 8 hours long. There's with the special features, the discussion there about the sun and ancient texts from the Vedic tradition and so on.
All right, let's go to the calls. We'll pick it up by first of all going to Santa Barbara, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, David, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure, Dave.
You know, I've gone to your website and read it years ago, or a year ago at least, I think now, and really looked at a lot of your videos on the net. So I'm pretty familiar with what you've done. I've been studying physics for a few years now, daily, for several hours a day. And so I got a pretty good grasp on alternative sciences, which I think is really where it's working, which really working. And you're really at the kind of the top of the field there. Now, I'm serious. I really do believe that. There's a question that I have for you that I haven't been able to get an answer for with many of the scientists that I know that are also in the alternative science. And then I got something I want to let you know about, too. And anyway, I was wondering if you believe that three space is, that's the three dimensions or the quantum vacuum or whatever you want to call it, that ether that's out there. There's a million different words for the same thing, and that's one of the problems. We don't have the same language as the rest of the physicists.
Right.
Now, this stuff is actually collapsing into, it's collapsing in through the atom or the protons and neutrons, whatever else is in the atom, into another dimension. Is that what you think is taking place?
Actually, you know, two things. One is I appreciate the comments and your background. It's great to hear that. And you know, this is why I call the vacuum the vacuum. You know, you could call it the plenum, you could call it the chi, you could call it, you know, like you're right, there's so many different names for the same thing. But I'm confined to using the word vacuum because when I say the vacuum to a physicist, specifically to a quantum physicist, then in general they know what I'm talking about. And I'm talking about this density of the vacuum that's called the Planck's density, which is 10 to the 94 or 10 to the 93 grams per centimeter cubed. It's extremely dense. It's more dense than all the stars in the universe put together in a centimeter cube of space. If you did that, if you took all the stars in the universe and you stuck them in a centimeter cube of space, you'd have about 10 to the 55th grams per centimeter cube. So you'd still be 38 to 39 orders of magnitude less than the density of the vacuum that actually is present at the atomic level, and that's been measured in laboratory using the Casimir effect and other things. And so basically, yes, I believe that it is collapsing, that actually the vacuum density, the energy of the vacuum is what produces the phenomenon that we call the atom. And it's because it's moving towards singularity, and through these movements towards singularity, you, as I said earlier, you can think of it as a fluid, you know, as a little vortex that's being generated as it's being sucked towards singularity. And that dynamic produces the magnetic and electromagnetic fields, the electron cloud, and all the dynamics we see in the atom, and which is 99.99999% space. And And when we think about it this way, then we start to realize there's a relationship between the center of the system and the edge of the system. So I don't believe it's going in another dimension as it collapses. I believe that actually it's feeding back, because as it spins towards singularity, it increases in velocity. So then centrifugal forces eventually and Coriolis forces take over and pulls it out at the equator of the system, and that's how I ended up with a double torus structure that you can see on my website. And in that double torus structure, information is moving in towards the center and then radiating out from the equator and moving back into the center, and in a continuous feedback loop that is the source of this, information network, which continuously learns about itself.
There you go. David, follow up on that?
Yeah, I do. That's pretty much exactly my view, too, except that I thought a portion of it might be collapsing into another dimension. Now, the one thing that you may not be aware of, because it's not published, is that there's a scientist out there that's a friend of mine, that is actually, through very carefully controlled electrical fields, been able to pop a proton from the quantum vacuum. And if you can pop one proton out of a quantum vacuum, then you can eventually pop a planet or a galaxy.
Very interesting. I'm not aware of that experiment, and that I believe that this is actually possible in our future. Like I said, if everything emerges from space and returns to space, then it is possible that if we understand the dynamics, and I believe the dynamics have to do with spin and velocities, angular momentum, that when we understand those dynamics, we can produce material directly out of the structure of space.
Nassim, I'm always fascinated at how incredible people have gotten into the fields that they're in. How did this happen for you? Interested in science when you were a little boy? What happened?
I was interested in science when I was a little boy. But I was actually very curious about the natural world, about our existence here and how it all worked. And, I wasn't doing so great at school, so I didn't, continue to explore that in the standard system of schooling. I had to do much of my studying independently, some 20 years of physics independently. And, that allowed me to develop in a way in which I could think my own thoughts, come to my own conclusions, and develop new views that are not necessarily inside the box that is taught inside the institutions.
Very good. Next up, we go to Atlanta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Jonathan, go ahead, John.
George, Hassim, great show.
He's one of a kind, isn't he?
Yeah, I'd like to hear maybe David Sarita, a new guest, on tonight. Maybe they could team up on Michio Cocker.
Oh, what a night that would be, huh?
Yeah. Hassim, you mentioned the Vedas. I think whoever it was that wrote the story of Indra's net had some great insight into, entanglement and the nature of entanglement, the connectedness of all matter and the universe. But David Sarita has also talked about, like what you were saying about singularity within all atoms and particles, I guess, popping in and out of the singularity. David Sarita was talking about, what's his name, Paul Dirac, I think one of the developers of quantum theory, and his theories kind of track along with what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Maybe. And also, how does that relate to... I'm sure you're familiar with the double slit experiment of firing an electron gun at a screen with two slits and it creating a wave pattern on a screen. And when it's measured and being observed, it collapses into more of a particle form on the screen. How does that relate to, the nature of the atom and popping in and out of singularity and the observer nature of reality, like John Wheeler talks about?
Oh, very good question. You know, first on Dirac, some of the papers that are available at my website, one of them in particular was a mathematical paper where I showed a direct correlation between, you know, the double torus structure and the Dirac equation that describes the electron cloud, the electron and positron cloud. But certainly, when, you know, the double slit experiment is a very interesting experiment, and it really, you know, the interpretation that was given to it is something that I've modified a little bit, and I have a little bit of a different interpretation of what occurs there. And the difference is that the standard view assumes that the particle that's fired from the gun is in free space, that there is nothing around it, that it's flow, you know, that there's absolute vacuum, that there is nothing there. And so it becomes mysterious and actually is the source of the, you know, interpretation of quantum theory and so on. It becomes very esoteric, very mysterious, because sometimes it's a particle and sometimes it's a wave, and if it's observed, it's changed and all this. But if you make a different assumption, if you make an assumption which is, you know, appropriate, since there's lots of evidence that the vacuum is full, that the particle is moving through a fluid-like structure, through a vacuum-like energy of the vacuum structure, well, think of it as a boat on the ocean. As it moves, it makes bow waves. And so as the particle moves, if there's only one slot in the experiment, then it will make a pattern of particle on the other side of that slot. But then if there's two slots, then the waves that the particle makes through the structure of the vacuum as it's moving through space would go through the second slot. And now you'd have a particle and a wave at the same time. And you'd think, oh, my God, this thing is a particle and a wave at the same time. And then imagine that you put an instrument in the field that measures. You could call it an observer. And now that observer is in the same field, and it's making waves in the structure of the vacuum, it's making disturbance in the structure of the vacuum, so now you'd get a completely different result again. And so it becomes less mysterious when you take a different approach and start to realize that nothing is in free space.
You know, it's amazing. So many people are so fascinated with physics.
Yes, because I think it's instinctively a fundamental question of how did reality get there and how did we get here and so on. I think most people have that inside of them somewhere.
If you went back into time, Nassim, and you were with Isaac Newton, what would you ask him?
What would I...
You get one question for Isaac Newton.
One question for Isaac Newton. I would ask him... how difficult was it to deal with all of the rest of the scientific community?
Next up, we go to Vinny in Vancouver. I like that. Hey, Vinny.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good.
This is a great show, by the way.
Thanks.
And if I could, I'd like to just use the two previous callers as a springboard.
All right, sure.
In fact, even the double slit experiment, really. One of the things that's always fascinated me in looking at this stuff, especially from an ulterior perspective, is how sort of the concept of time kind of plays into it. And what I'd like to ask the doctor is, like, you know, with regards to this interpretation, which I think was even classified as the Copenhagen interpretation, mm-hmm. And with regards to just quantum mechanics in general, isn't there kind of a logical discontinuity as far as cause and effect? And doesn't that really kind of play into why the standard model isn't really, why most people just have a hard time with the standard model, because it really doesn't factor in cause and effect?
Yes, it's a discontinuity in understanding of the mechanics of creation. you know, all of a sudden quantum theory, and you're correct, the Copenhagen interpretation, jumped to a model of the atomic structure of the way the material world is made that is very non-mechanical, very esoteric, that where particles can do all sorts of things that are, you know, not thought to be possible from mechanical function in the macro world. And, you know, in one way, and certainly Einstein thought so, this was a cop-out, a way to not have to, like, think harder and figure out how is these experiments, what are these experiments truly showing us? You know, Einstein truly believed that there was a fundamental mechanical function to the atomic level, that there was geometry involved, and that there must be a way to understand this in a way that, you know, that makes more fundamental sense in terms of the mechanics of creation instead of a very esoteric theory that says, oh, particles can be waves and particle at the same time, and you can't visualize it, and you shouldn't try to visualize it, and, you know, that, you know, entanglement particles can, you know, be millions and millions apart from each other, and you change one and the other one change instantaneously and all this. I mean, the fact that these experiments are there shows us that there must be some fundamental dynamics that we don't understand. But instead, what I believe happened is we jumped to conclusions that were convenient for our equations. And one of those conclusions was when we discovered that the protons are highly charged particles and they're squished together in the nuclei of an atom, very, very close together, and they have a high charge. You know, the mathematics in classical mechanics and static electricity should say that that the energy of these protons, like two magnets coming together, should repel, you know, each other, and the atom should not exist. Well, instead of trying to reassess our idea of what an atom is, we came up with the idea that there's some kind of strong, mysterious force that holds the atom together. We calculated how strong it had to be, and we just stuck it in there with no source for it, no explanation where the mechanics came from to produce that force or anything like that. And so, you know, what I'm showing now is, no, there is actually fundamental mechanics that produce that force, and it's called a mini black hole. And when you have a mini black hole singularity at the nuclei of an atom, you have exactly the amount of force necessary to hold the protons together. And it's understandable that they couldn't come to that conclusion then. Black holes were not even discovered at the time. You know, they were theoretically predicted by Einstein's equation, but even Einstein didn't like the idea that his equation predicted singularities and black holes.
Nassim, when we come back, we'll take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back. Okay, we're going to take your final calls with the physicist Nassim Hedemain when we come back. In the next hour, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment. Nassim, tell me a little bit more about your training programs and your conferences and your speeches.
Oh, well, you know, at the Resonance Project, we are putting together like organizational structures so that we can help the public to, you know, get deeper into the science and philosophy and the ancient culture knowledge that I've gathered all through these years. And so, you know, we kept on running into issues where people were saying, well, you know, I love your seminars and your talk and everything, but you know, it's so fast and there's so much information and I need a little more time and all this. So we finally started to give organize for weekend seminars that I call delegate programs. And in the delegate program, you know, we spend 2 days and a half together and I go through all the information and, you know, people are able to ask questions and we spend a lot of time together and it's a wonderful weekend all together. and lots of learning and exploration. And then there's the emissary program. And the emissary program is a program I set up because I need to duplicate myself. It's important for people to get this information, and it's really hard for me to continue to do research, ongoing research, and at the same time be out there giving talks everywhere in the world. So I start to train people so that they could give the talks, and that's more of a elaborate program. It's 10 days altogether, and people get my presentation and a big book, and we study together, and then when they come out, they're ready to give talks.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Long Beach, California. Hey, Ralph, go ahead. First-time caller.
Hello, George.
Hey.
Hey, Nassim, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Oh, thank you.
I had a quick, reasonable theory here. The thing was, is I always had a curiosity about the sun and all, and you know how we were taught that it has certain layers and whatnot?
Yes.
Okay, but technically we've never really dissected a star to actually know what's inside of it, and I know it's just some kind of a thing with nuclear fusion and whatnot, but my kind of reasonable thing here would be, since space is supposedly made out of carbon dioxide, when you have fire and you surround it by carbon dioxide, it technically would put it out, correct?
Yes. If the yes.
And so, I mean, I don't know, in theory, because of the fact that oxygen fuels a fire, wouldn't it be reasonable that oxygen, even as a gas, would probably be fueling the sun from the inside?
That's a good question, actually. You know, the thoughts, the current thoughts on the reason why the sun is burning is nuclear fusion. That is, the nuclei of the atoms are so densely packed at certain levels of density of the sun that it starts fusing under its own weight, and that's the energy output that we see. So, but there is all sorts of really strange things about the sun, the way, you know, that we would, most people think we know why the sun is burning and how it's burning and all this stuff. Actually, there's anomalies there. For instance, in order for nuclear fusion to occur that way, a certain amount of particles called neutrinos should be produced, and we know how much neutrinos should be produced. Well, when we try to detect those neutrinos, we are missing some 80% of the neutrinos that should be produced in order for the sun to burn. So that's a big anomaly. There's other anomalies, like the fact that the corona of the sun is much hotter than the surface of the sun. Interesting facts that most people don't know about. For instance, the fact that water seems to emerge from sunspots, which are large vortices, large black vortices on the surface of the sun. And there we see, you know, spectral lines of water come out. And you wouldn't expect that, right beside the fire of the sun. And so, yeah, oxygen and so on. And so there is very complex physics involved there, very complex dynamics that are going on. And I believe wholeheartedly in the last section of my scaling law paper that you can find on our website, I described the fact that the sun's core is in the correct ratio relative to the galactic core for the sun to host a mini black hole at its center. This theory says that these power levels, the dynamics that makes the sun burn, or the dynamics that makes planets like Jupiter and Saturn emanate more energy or radiate more energy than it receives from the sun, or the fact that the center of the Earth produces large amount of heat and magnetic fields and so on, is because they are powered by little singularities, by little black holes.
Okay, thank you. Let's go next to Brooklyn, New York. Jan, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
Hi.
You asked earlier about, you were talking about how the nutrients affect matter. Now, I was wondering, the GM food now that's being served, to human beings? How do you think it's going to affect matter? Do you think people are going to be born with dumber brains? also, the Union of Concerned Scientists and the American Academy of Environmental Medicine just came out last year and said how it's affecting people's liver and spleen and aging, and even GM food doesn't even give more yield. So
all right. Counts. What's your take, Nassim, on GM foods? You're changing things, aren't they?
They are. And, you know, they're changing things at levels where we have very little control, little understanding, and where the chain of events that makes our biology and our biosphere possible and operative and striving is a very, very delicate chain. And messing around with it, I think, is not a good idea. And, you know, I think that it's been shown that things could be done in a completely different way to produce all the food we need and so on. So I think that it's really important that we go back to a level of reverence for nature and take a little pause on the expenditure of our technology and our capacity to modify things before we put them into the environment.
Okay, next up we've got you, Wally, in Flat Rock, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hi, Wally.
Hey, thank you, George.
Sure.
Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I wanted to ask your guest a couple of questions. First, I heard him mention neutrinos a few minutes earlier. And I know a neutrino is so minute, it can pass through an atom without even touching it. Am I correct?
Yes. It's very.
And there are things even smaller, like quarks,
uh-huh,
that are smaller than neutrinos. And the distance between these particles is relative to possibly the distance between the Earth and the nearest star.
Uh-huh.
Now, this space is so... I think space is probably the key to practically everything in physics.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. That's exactly where I'm coming from. I'm saying that the space is what's producing the phenomenon that we call matter. Basically, when we look at particles, we're looking at the little jiggling of the space, a little oscillation of the space. And because it produces an energetic effect, we say, oh, there's something over here. But then when we look carefully at that thing, we find that it's mostly made out of space. You're absolutely right. I mean, the atom is 99.99999% space. You don't expect that when you look at the material world. You think, oh, my God, it's very dense, you know, when you touch the table. But actually, it's mostly space. And you can find very dynamic energy structures inside that space. It's not dead space. It's not empty space. It's very energetic. And when you try to calculate how energetic it is, it's incredible. The density of the energy available in the space is remarkable. And I think it's really something we need to explore because I don't believe that we're in a universe that's running down, that's low in energy, that put us on this planet that with no means to achieve higher levels of energy and so on, either than pumping oil out of the ground and so on. So I think that is the wave of the future.
Okay, very good. Couple more calls to go. Kennedy in Taos, New Mexico, first-time caller. Hi, Kennedy.
Hi, George. Hi, Nassim. I'm proud to say that I am a delegate of the Resonance Project. It is an amazing, amazing program. Nassim, I'd like to know briefly, and I'll take my answer off the air, what you think of the theory of fractal time and applying the phi ratio and the fractal nature of the universe to a theory of time.
Yes, very good. Fractal, you see, in the view that I'm bringing forward, time is a function of the frame dragging of space. And so let me explain that a little bit. You know, this vacuum energy, this vacuum structure, you could think of it as a, you know, a little bit like if you were steering a pot of molasses and, you know, it would drag behind a little bit where you're steering. That's called frame dragging. And it actually is predicted by Einstein field equations. And it's been attempted to be measured. It was measured in various ways. And it's somewhat confirmed. And so what I'm saying is that I absolutely agree. I think that time is directly related to this fractal division of the space, this fractal scaling of the space. So, for instance, time for a galaxy size is completely different than time for a human being on the surface of a planet, you know, or time for an atom is different, again, because each scales of the fractal defines a different frame of reference for the time structure.
Okay, we've got Jen in Cincinnati, Ohio. Now it's your turn. Hi, Jen.
Yes, hello. Nassim had mentioned earlier about sacred geometry.
Yes.
And I was wondering what he thought about the possibility of Merkaba being like a hyperdimensional aspect of spirit.
Oh, that's a good question. I think that many ancient texts talked about the fundamental geometry of space as sacred geometry because they thought this is the fundamental geometry of creation. So they thought of it as sacred. And, you know, and because these ancient civilizations were not necessarily very technical, you know, they were not very advanced, and maybe because they got the information from very advanced beings that they were in contact with, they may not have completely understood it. And so most of the information is always interpreted in very esoteric, philosophical interpretation. I think it has to do much more with the physics of creation itself. And, you know, and since, and if it's correct, if these geometries, when they're decoded, give the formula, the mathematics for the foundation of our existence, then for sure it should apply to the structure of our consciousness, the structure of the information that makes us who we are, and if you wanted to call it the soul, you know. And so it'd be the geometry of our soul in the structure of the vacuum, absolutely.
Okay, next up we have a San Diego caller west of the Rockies. It's Tom. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hi, George. Nassim and George, both, you're invited to our Sun God Festival down here. It's a mix of music and science students.
When is that?
San Diego. It's end of March.
Okay.
My question is this. We often hear and learn on Coast to Coast about the string theory, about membranes, about dark matter and dark energy. And those are the terms that most of us have learned about this subject. Could you compare and contrast your theories to those standard theories? Last Friday, Michio Kaku said that this is the only thing left for physicists to hang on to. It's the number of dimensions and the types of strings. There's nothing else to be discussed any longer.
Yes. Well, you know, this I think is a typical thing that occurs in physics. And by the way, thank you for the invitation. I'd love to go to the Sun God Festival if I get a chance. I think that you know, in physics and in science in general, we go from you know, interpretation to very complex description of what we're trying to achieve in our understanding. And then eventually somebody comes along, or, you know, a group of individuals or so on, and, you know, and then a simple view emerges. And And I just have that sense when you look at the complexity of string theory and many difficulties that are involving dark matter and dark energy. I mean, dark matter and dark energy is a little bit like the strong force, you know. It's like, oh, we're just going to invent a kind of matter that doesn't radiate, that's just in the right percentage and exactly the right place to make the equation work, you know. But we're not going to say where it came from, how it got there, you know, and so on. And so, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that approach to physics. I believe that if we run into a problem, for instance, missing some 96% the mass of the universe, most likely is because we made an error in our interpretation somewhere, an error in our equation somewhere. And if we revise our previous approach, I think we can repair that. And part of it is to realize that atoms are mini black holes.
Okay, let's go to one more final caller, Jess in Lancaster, California. Go ahead, Jess, real quickly.
Hey, how you doing? It's actually Jeff. Anyways, I don't know if it's a question or a thought, is space goes on forever, right? Well, also, and let's say an atom is the smallest thing there is, and you cut an atom in half, and you can always keep going and going and going smaller, smaller, smaller. So I've always wanted to say that as much as space can go on forever, so can small. There's never, you can never not have something. So I don't know, you know.
Very good.
Go ahead, Nassim.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly what I'm saying is actually when you start cutting the atom in pieces, eventually you start realizing that what you're cutting in piece that you think is some kind of material world is actually the space that you're dividing. And, you know, that kind of twists your view of the universe around. All of a sudden, the space is what produces the atomic structure, not the atomic structure defining the space.
I would have liked for you to have been our physics teacher when we were kids, Nassim, except you're younger than we were.
Well, hopefully, eventually, this will be the physics that are taught.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Nassim Hedamain. Up next, Joshua P. Warren and his paranormal moment.